Hey everyone, this is Brian with just a couple of quick notes about this episode. So because of our format, Marvel by the Month is a podcast that requires a lot of advanced planning and preparation. We're more like a monthly magazine than we are like a daily or weekly newspaper. So this episode was planned weeks before we recorded it, and it only really reflects current events in a very limited way. But just so there's no confusion, we believe that Black Lives Matter. And we are committed to using our little platform to amplify Black voices and support Black creators and retailers. And you are going to see that commitment in the coming weeks and months. So with that said, I hope you enjoy what is absolutely the funniest episode of Marvel by the Month that we have ever done. If you are familiar with our guest, you will not be surprised to hear that there are some cusses, which means that I got to insert a bunch of 1967 Fantastic Four cartoon sound effects over them. And there's at least one bit where we talk about getting punched in a very sensitive area. I'm not saying that this episode is not for kids, but I'm also not saying that it's not for kids. I'm not going to tell you how to raise your kids. I can barely raise my own. Thanks for listening. And here comes the best podcast theme song ever. Still the man, Jack the King, man of iron, ankles with wings, 12 cents admission to the show.
Of living beings on this earth.
Their fate can be no concern of Galactus.
We'll make it your concern.
Hey there and welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Well, Rob, this has been quite a week.
Yeah. It got the darkest timeline is spiraling. I kind of see hope in that this specific week of riots. My anarchist, 18-year-old self is way for this. Yeah, it wanted this most of my life. So now I'm a little more tempered and rounded and soft, but I still support it.
Well, so just for context, we're recording this on June 3rd, Wednesday, June 3rd. So things have sort of started to maybe calm down slightly. I don't know, but it has been a hell of a thing. I don't really know what to say about it. It feels like a silly thing to like make big pronouncements about, but we are very much in favor of anyone who is trying to create a more just and equitable society. And we are doing what we can to help support that. In the meantime, we're just going to keep recording our dumb podcast about 1960s comics.
We did, take our first week off of posting.
That seemed like the right move. I just felt like that we were not the voices that people needed to hear that week. So,
yeah.
We are back on the horse, and we have a very special guest joining us who I'm very excited to welcome onto the program. So let me just do a little setup here. Okay. A real professional style introduction. So our guest on this week's show, he was the creator of the very first humor website ever. You've read his hilarity in Electronic Gaming Monthly, OneUp.com, and Cracked.com. He probably broke your brain with his math-based mobile game Calculords, and he's the co-founder of the virile new comedy site 1-900-HOT-DOG, coming at you live from the internet. It's Sean Baby.
Yay. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for the great intro.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a blast.
Yes. And full disclosure, Brian and I are old and dear friends. So it's probably going to be that kind of awkward where we know each other too well to have a healthy conversation in an interview style way.
That sounds like how we do this every week. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So exactly. It's just another funnier voice will be nice. Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure. I wanted to get real serious And no, I don't. I don't at all. I hardly ever chime in on things like that. In fact, like you're talking about taking the week off so other people can like let their voices be heard. I'm like, no, I'll just write some fucking jokes about like He-Man.
That's what the world needs now. Honest to God, there have absolutely been times, especially in these last couple months, where it's like, I really could just go for a thick stack of He-Man jokes right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot of heroes don't call themselves that, but I do all the time. I've been a hero all week. It's effortless. It's just you write He-Man jokes, call yourself a hero, done.
As I do about this time of year, ever since, I think Brian might have recommended it, but you, Sean, you'd posted this great how-to 4th of July. it's been, I send it to people every year, and it represents much of my childhood. So I grew up on, my family had a junkyard. We blew up lots of things and
I almost burned down Brian's house one year.
Yeah, that's true.
That was a good year.
It was just a rental, though, right?
I think that was one of the years where we discovered that the cocktail waitress at our regular bar, when I say regular bar, we were there two nights a week for like 8 years.
Yes.
We found her family owned the fireworks stand. And so I was there with probably $300 worth of fireworks. And she goes, oh, let me get that to you for free and go get whatever else you want. So we had more fireworks than was conceivable, an absurd amount of fireworks. And so... that was a good year. And then we spent hours gluing them together. And because that was sort of a standard thing my dad did when I was a kid. He would buy way too many fireworks and we just kind of get bored throwing the ground blue flowers, just trying to get through them. And so we started gluing them together and creating like staged, I guess, bomb. I guess you'd call it bombs. Yeah.
I guess now in retrospect, the FBI was right to consider them improvised explosive devices.
Those were improvised explosives. Like there's a high chance of blowing a finger or two off at the very least.
Yes. Yeah.
Whatever. We did. We were in an unsupervised area for a while. That was a cul-de-sac that was industrial with one house. So this is me like 20 years old with two bands and, you know, living in a giant house. And we got mortars. We got big, full-on mortars. And we would like, so let's put the mortar inside a pinata, float it in a bucket of gas, and light that on fire. Light the pinata on fire and wait for what happens.
I'd allow that. Yeah, that sounds, depending on the bucket size, it seems pretty safe.
It's a 5 gallon bucket, but we didn't destroy any businesses or any lives.
Those mortars have like a really long fuse. Yeah, plenty of time to get to a safe distance.
Yep,
so when I imagine the bucket exploded and launched a pretty good blast of napalm in a big.
There was a flaming, it was an amazing flaming arc of just on, it was like if Johnny Storm farted, like it was a.
Or sharded,
I think it would be more napalmy in that way. Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, so I saw what you had done and put together in this coherent way, and it made me proud to be an American. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah,
thank you. That's what I was going for.
Yeah.
Well, if we're gonna talk about old school Sean Baby content, so I am old enough to I think the first exposure I had to your work was when you did the character assassinations of the Super Friends.
Oh yes,
on SeanBaby.com, which was wonderful. I had a job at Gamers.com at the time where they just neglected to give me anything to do for the first 3 weeks I was there. So I think I read every word on your site, which was great. And then I was like, well, someday maybe I'll meet this guy.
We were fast friends.
Yeah,
a lot of that early stuff it doesn't quite hold up. Like some of it sort of looks like hate crime now.
You know what I mean?
Like the naughtiness we had in the late 90s it doesn't resonate anymore.
Right.
Like at the time it was sort of like, you guys know I'm kidding, right? But like you look at it now, you're like, this guy's not kidding.
He's a piece of crap. Yeah. It was like early South Park. We've had conversations where, you do the comedy to be shocking at the time, and then you live with it.
Yeah, and then you discover that people have feelings,
right? But I think the same thing might be happening in comics. Like when I look at old comics, they're just unspeakably racist, like pre 1950, like.
Yeah.
Like Shazam had like a little slave, like this weird little blackface boy who followed him around. It's like, oh, Miss Shazam, I'm sure hoping you know. You're like, I can't believe they did that. And that's the only black character that was in comics. And at the time where they like, this would be funny if I do another cliche like blackface character. You know I don't mean it, right? But like, I don't. I think I might be giving him too much credit because every single one of the characters was like that.
So far, I think in everything we read for the podcast, I think there have been like maybe two black characters who have shown up. Like one of them is he's one of the Howling Commandos, and he has no personality except he plays a trumpet. The other one was like a POW who Captain America rescues. And I think that's literally it. Like Black Panther hasn't shown up yet.
Jive talking blackface things. They were.
Well, there's Zemo's slaves. And then there's the demon, the Asian witch doctor. And it's really racist still. It's just not quite as racist.
Oh man. So Sean, you're a huge comics fan. Ever since I've known you, you have been extraordinarily comics literate. Have you read any of the stuff that we read for this episode before? Were you familiar with it beforehand?
I'd at least once in my life read every single one of these comics. Yeah.
That's awesome. Without getting into the detail, we'll save that for later on. But what were some of your like high level takeaways on 1960s Marvel comics?
Oh, I think Stanley has this way of writing where he thinks of the most obvious question the reader might have and then pays like really klutzy lip service to it and then like continues on as if it doesn't matter. That's the thing I think of when I think of 60s comics. It's like any idiot would look at like these predicaments the X-Men are in or that Thor is in. You're like, oh, here's how you'd get out of that with his, you know, obvious power set. And then Stanley's like, oh, no. He can't do that right here. Because I don't know, the wind currents.
You've luckily missed the Johnny Storm run of Strange Tales, but Johnny Storm also just loses power every 5 seconds. Like he's just he hasn't taken the time to find out how long he can run at certain levels. He's just a kid. He's just gonna go ahead and burn out.
He's gonna get 600 feet in the air, 70 miles an hour, and then just hope things work out. Much like how you and I built fireworks as children.
That is true. Yeah, we still have our eyes somehow.
All right. Well, I'm excited to talk about all this stuff with you guys. But first, we start every episode off with providing a little bit of historical context around what was going on in the world when these episodes hit, to make them maybe slightly more understandable why some of the decisions were made. So let's go ahead and just hit on a couple things. Rob, do you want to kick us off? Because we're going to start out with some Beatles by the month and a little bit of Scandal from January 1966.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know about this. It's like the Milli Vanilli of the Beatles. Because of the poor quality of, this is on the 5th of January 1966, but because of the poor quality of the sound recording of their August 15th concert at Shea Stadium, the Beatles went into a studio and re-recorded most of their songs for a TV documentary. The crowd noises were dubbed in as well to make the film seem like the original performance. So, and I've heard the real recordings of what happened in Shea Stadium, and it sounds like crap. It's like a tiny PA being overwhelmed.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like that's a scandal to me. Like Milli Vanilli was a scandal.
Yeah.
They lied.
Yeah, I don't think most people never knew or cared about this. It was nothing like Milli Vanilli.
Milli Vanilli had that magic moment where they got caught, where they were lip syncing, and then it goes, girl, you know, it's girl, you know, it's girl, you know, which is the titular line from their main song, so it's the perfect time for it to pick up. But everyone in the world knows that sometimes people lip sync, right? It's American Bandstand. No one ever sang the original song, so it's not a big deal. But one of them sprints off stage just like in a sheer panic while the other one pretends like it's supposed to be like that. And he starts doing the running man. And I just love how they both solve the problem in the wrong way, but in different directions. I don't know.
It's fight or flight or, you know.
Yeah. Let's see. On the 7th of January 1966, Lou Thesz, who was dubbed the Babe Ruth of professional wrestling, was defeated for the National Wrestling Association Championship for the last time, losing to Gene Kaniski. Fez's multiple reigns as NWA champion totaled more than 10 years. He would later be elected as a charter member of the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame. Sean, are you in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame? You have a pro wrestling background.
Not much of one. I did like two shows in Portland.
Yes.
At the Ash Street Saloon was where we did. They didn't have a ring. It was just a stage over some cement floor. I took a front bump onto that cement floor from the stage. That was a mistake. Oh. Also, I'm not good at the front bump, so I over-rotated and kind of landed on my tailbone.
Oh, jeez.
I was in my 20s. You could really just shake off a bone fracture like with a couple of beers at that time.
Wow. But,
yeah, I was Captain Party was my name there.
And the outfit was, it was the, what, yellow jumpsuit with the...
Right.
The beer hat.
It was designed backwards from the Ultimate Party costume. I was completely waterproof. I had a belt that dispensed beers. I was supposed to be like like a super powered frat boy, which I thought would play as a heel to the hip Portland hipster crowd, but it did not. I was a crowd pleaser, so whatever.
You were a cool heel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of a rule breaking good guy, like Stone Cold, who uses Luthez's press in his moveset.
Yes, he does. Yep.
Nerd readers, I'm sure, know already.
Let's see. On the 17th of January, 1966, Gary Big Daddy Goodridge, the Trinidadian kickboxer, mixed martial arts athlete, and world arm wrestling champion, was born in St. James.
I'm a huge fan of Gary Goodridge. He had a UFC debut against this guy, and I can't even remember his name. I didn't prepare for any of this. You should have sent me all these news acts. But anyway.
I love that you're just rocking this off the dome, though. This is amazing.
I like stuff. So this dude, the announcers were like, oh, his modeling and acting career wasn't going anywhere. So here he is in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And so you're like, oh, this fucking poor dude. And immediately, Gary Goodrich pulls him down, grabs one arm, wraps the other arm up in his legs. So the guy's in a crucifix. Gary Goodrich pulls one arm out. And he just unloads elbow strikes to this guy's head, unconscious after the first elbow. Oh. And the other ones are just taking years off of his life. It's the most savage UFC knockout. Anyway, I love Gary Goodrich. He listed his fighting style as arm wrestling in Pride Fighting Championships, where he was just a journeyman. Like, they just throw him in the ring with whoever just to sort of see what they could do against Gary Goodrich. So sometimes he would get obliterated. Sometimes he would knock a dude's head off. Anyway, I love him. He's not faring super well. His fight career did not make him very wealthy, and he had a lot of health problems. But send your love and support to Gary Goodrich.
We'll put the GoFundMe in the show notes. Rob, do you want to do the last one too?
I feel like
this is a Rob factoid.
Yeah, on January 23rd, 1966, Bob Knievel of Montana and his group of motorcycle riders put on his first public show under his new name, performing for 2 hours at the National Date Festival in Indio, California, as Evil Knievel and the Motorcycle Daredevils.
I love his name is Bob Knievel.
Yep.
I kind of wish he had stuck with that. Like,
well, that's why we got Robbie Knievel, you know, with the junior. So it was like, I'm a Robert myself, and I also did try to jump things over things as a kid, and somehow I'm still alive. So,
yep.
That's the thing. You know, if you have a junkyard and they say, like, just don't ruin the engine, here you go, and give us two cars and a field that we...
You're going to jump them.
Yeah, we're going to jump them. We're going to roll them. We're going to somehow survive.
We all got through it. We got through these childhoods.
All right. So that's a taste of what was going on in January 1966 when all these books hit the newsstands. We're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we are going to meet a dashing new Captain America villain who I think we're all very excited to talk about. So we'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We are going to kick things off with a little section we're going to call Zoot Allure. It's Batroc. So this story takes place over the course of Tales of Suspense number 75, Tales of Suspense number 76. It is written by Stan Lee. The first part, the layouts are by Jack Kirby, the art's by Dick Ayers, inked by John Tartaglione. The second part, also written by Stan, and all of the art is by John Romita, who's starting to get more work. And there's a reason for that, which we'll find out when Steve Ditko leaves in a huff in a few months. Sean, I assume that Batroc is probably one of your favorite supervillains of all time.
I do love Batroc. He's the perfect combination of like ludicrous, but sort of a threat. Like he's so clearly supernatural. Like he's supposed to just be a guy who's good at savate, but he's like kicking through cement and like taking these 30-foot jumps, and Captain America just fucking lays him out with the shield, and Batroc's like, oh, ho, ho, he's a pretty good shot. Oh. Like, Jesus, he just took it. Anyway, and he also, he doesn't seem to think that anything's a threat to him, but not in a, like a hubris kind of way. Like he's just like, nah, I can totally take Captain America. I got a pretty good shot in this fight.
I think this also marks the point where Stan Lee learned about a second martial art other than judo.
Yeah, right? Everybody's judoing all the time.
Well, Captain America gamed it instantly too. He's like, oh, look, savate, the French style of boxing with your feet. I guess I was doing a French accent for Captain America. Sorry about that.
It's contagious. Yeah.
It's really hard to stop.
Yeah. So, I mean, and also this gives Stan a chance to show off the 12 words of French he remembers from high school. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the character is played by Georges St-Pierre in Winter Soldier. So
I really like that fight, too.
That's a good fight. Yeah, that was really
well
coordinated.
I like a nice gentleman's fight where they're fighting and he's like, hey, put your shield away. And Captain America's like, all right.
It's great. It's a great way to kick that movie off. I think it might be my favorite of the Marvel movies. I love Winter Soldier. It's
What I want you to, next time you watch Winter Soldier, I want you to look at the front kicks.
Okay.
Like they get in these fights and Captain America will just like punch, shield bash, punch, kick. And then when he lands that front kick, the guy's like 40 feet into the ocean. And it's the same for every, like the fight choreographer is just like, how do we make it look like you really hit somebody? You know what? Let's do the front kick again. Anyway, once you see it, every fight scene becomes hilarious.
Nice.
Oh, this sounds like a drinking game too.
Yep. So in the first half of the story, we have a shadowy organization. They're trying to recover a sample of something called Inferno 42, which is apparently
rules.
Yeah. The most destructive element of all time. It was stolen from them by an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I love that they show off its destructive potential with this needlessly elaborate demonstration.
He built a little terrarium
with a city
diorama. Yeah. Behold the power of a diorama destroying parachute bomb. They drop a little parachute of the bomb from the ceiling.
It just looks like they destroyed an aquarium. Like, like somebody's turtle got toasted there is what it looks like.
It seems like it should be unimpressive, but as a reader and the people in the comic, everyone's like, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is a very powerful thing and it's worth $1 million or whatever.
Right. The $1 million that they're going to pay Batroc to try to recover it.
Inferno 42 is very scary.
Yes. Yeah. And you know that this is the 42nd time they tried to get it right. So, right. I mean, this has been researched.
They almost killed 41 aquariums. They finally found the formula.
It's so good. So then after we see what Inferno 42 can do, we cut to Captain America. He's recovering from his last mission. And he remembers, he's thinking about this woman he met in World War II who he just can't forget.
You're just going to skip over how, like, the cliffhanger of him being in the air was, like, 9 pages ago. Like, whole time, Captain America has been midair.
Yes.
While we're learning about Inferno 42.
Yep. He's just floating. That's a holdover from the previous issue where he beat a combined 3 Red Skull Nazi robots.
Wow.
Which was,
was that the sleeper?
Yeah.
Yes.
The sleeper.
Yep. You know your stuff.
You're right. I am comic literate now that you mention it.
Oh, man. So Cap, you know, he's still, you know, man out of time, dwelling on this woman he met in World War II. He decides he's got to clear his head. So he hits the streets in his civilian clothes, which involves him somehow hiding his shield under his jacket. I've never figured out how that actually works.
You got to just let stuff like that go.
Yeah,
we're going to go crazy.
It's Warren Worthington, like the angel. Yeah.
Angel just like sticks his wings in his back pocket. He's like, guys, it's cool. No one will know.
That had to just look like somebody with just the most amazing back hair or something. You know, if you saw him for real. I don't know.
And so after obsessing about this woman in just a funny quirk of fate, Cap's walking the streets of New York and he bumps into this woman who reminds him exactly of the woman he was just thinking about, but that's not possible because this is 20 years later. Like, how can she be the same person?
I saved this panel because it's incredible. This is not my panel of the week or whatever, but she walks away after they're kind of like, ooh, yeah, I think I know who you are. I think I know who you are. She goes, I almost made a fool of myself. Sis had told me so often of the boy she knew in World War II, but he'd be much older by now. It couldn't have been him.
what would he have thought if I asked him, is your name Steve Rogers? Like, she knew who he was from a description of her older sister's boyfriend 25 years ago?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yep.
It's just elegant writing is my point.
It's just airtight.
He bumps into a woman who does police sketches in her brain from 25-year-old descriptions of boyfriends. A lot of writers wouldn't take that risk.
Well, that's the kind of mental abilities you need if you're going to be a SHIELD agent, which is exactly what she is. So she bumps into a dude. They exchange identical cylindrical packages. And then our good friend Batroc shows up.
And all of this theater was for him.
Yes.
The whole cylindrical swap, that was to fool Batroc.
Right.
The Leaper.
Exactly.
And it does not.
It does not. He stalks the guy she bumped into. And he steals the package from him by leaping.
30-foot flying drop kick. Guy's dead. They don't cut back to show.
At least paralyzed. Yeah.
Spine is shattered.
Yeah. He's going on permanent disability after this. But so Batroc gets the package, but he realizes he got a decoy, and the woman he bumped into must be the SHIELD agent who has the real Inferno 42. So very tightly crafted spy thriller drama stuff going on here.
And I know we do this usually. So a character's been introduced. We need to describe his look. This guy, he's got a purple and orange. He's
an unusual combination of colors.
If he was going to go French, you know, he could have been red, white, and blue too. And but anyway, he's purple and orange, mostly purple with orange accents. He's got a hood that goes over his ears and eyes. But on his eyes, he has this pointy mask. And then he has a mustache that is, it's godlike. It's something to be beheld. It sticks out a good 3 inches to either side. Like just
It goes past the mask. It goes past his Wolverine mask.
Yeah. Yep. And then he's got a straight cropped Abraham Lincoln sort of going on the bottom.
Yeah. Bulging out of the sides of his mask. And you haven't mentioned he's kind of got a W on his tummy. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's kind of, it is. It's pretty much a W. It looks vaguely as bad as, it's not as bad as Wonder Man's costume, but it's up there. But he just owns it.
Batroc fucking rules.
Batroc's got the package. He realizes he's been fooled. Cap and the woman part ways. And then a shot rings out. Cap ducks into an alleyway, changes into costume. He sees Batroc trying to steal the Inferno 42. So, of course, Cap and Batroc have to fight. That's what happens now.
And Cap leaps in at him, like from way off panel. He's doing like a 10, 12 foot leap.
Yeah, you get Sonic kicked for it.
Yeah.
You can't come with that weak shit at Batroc.
So they tussle. The mystery woman escapes with the Inferno 42.
I think tussle, let's backtrack a little.
Okay.
Because Cap comes back from getting Sonic kicked with a dick punch. And the sound effect is splat. And then he hits him with a shield and then hits him with a second dick punch. This one very clearly to the dick.
Yeah. Like
explosion on the dick. There's no like forced perspective to make it look like, you hit him in the face and now he's like flying backwards and the explosion's where his face was and it's now his dick. No, this is he's hitting him in the dick.
That is. Now, once you say
no
that,
question,
you can't unsee the way the sound effect and the power balloon that's the sound effect balloon coming off of that is very much right there.
Yeah. The splat, you could argue, Batroc is where he's been punched to, and you're seeing the explosion line where the punch connected. A lot of comic book impacts look like dick punches because of this artistic choice. But the second one, there's just no question. Captain hit him with a right hook straight across the dick.
And that does knock him down. That is what takes him down. The second, the pow.
He doesn't complain.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Batroc. He's not like, oh, you foul creature punching a man in the groin. He's just like, the cylinder, sacre bleu. Never leaves the moment.
Yep.
He just assumes he's going to get punched in the dick a few times. He's a man. He's going to take it.
He's committed. He's got $1,000,000 $1,966 on the line here. So the woman escapes with the Inferno 42, and Batroc gets a temporary hold on the fight with Cap because he tells him the package is damaged. It's going to detonate in 30 minutes. So they start looking for her. She disappears into a hidden door in a brick wall. And there's our cliffhanger for the first part.
I love the quote here from Batroc, where he goes, "She is no ordinary female. She is an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Now stand aside while Batroc prepares to make his greatest leaps." He's just like, this shit is so fucking sweet, Captain America. You just gotta like get ready for it. Like, these jumps are gonna blow your mind. And Captain America thinks, "An agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.? I never dreamt. I've got to reach her." Like, stay in the moment, Captain America. That's what I'm saying. Batroc is present and ready for action, and Captain America is just a scatterbrained idiot.
Oh, Cap is like, he is just a walking pile of PTSD at this point. He's got all the trauma from World War II, and then like he's fast forwarded instantly 20 years. All his friends are dead or missing. Like, he's a mess.
Then he gets that weird Rick Jones fixation for a bit. "You're going to be my new Bucky."
Yeah, yeah. He does. And he's got that that 60s style of comic storytelling where he's constantly reminding the reader like of his personal history. So he's just having these long, long deep dives into his own psyche. Like whenever he's walking along the street, like, "Oh, I've got to like deal with this and this and this. And this is who I am. And this is where I came from." You're like, "Jesus Christ, you sound crazy." You don't see Batroc doing that.
No.
We don't see Batroc going, "Oh, I've been punched in the dick. I must think back to when I was a child and learned savant in the forest." No.
There's very little evidence that Batroc has any internal monologue whatsoever.
That's true. Not. What is the next thing I can leap on?
Yeah. He likes to mention leaping, but, you know, or just the job. He's on the job. He leaps. That's his thing.
He's a professional.
And his character stays pretty consistent in that way. I mean, he was recently in a Gwenpool run that was pretty hilarious. And he's still just, "Give me a job. I'll do the job and I will do it well. I will leap from building to building because that is what I do."
He does one thing and he does it very, very well.
"And you must stand back to behold it."
And so that's what Cap does. He stands back and beholds at the very beginning of the second part of the story as Batroc is kicking in the door that the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent escaped through. And this makes her think that they're in cahoots. She thinks Cap's an impersonator.
You keep skipping over the best stuff. He made Captain America get out of the way so he could kick it open. Captain America's like struggling to open this brick wall. And Batroc's like, "Get out of the way. I can leap through it." And he does.
And the door, you said door. And I'm like, well, it's a closing interlocked brick wall of a door. So,
And Batroc leaps through it like a man.
And with the craziest expression on his face. He's just like demented and having the time of his life. And I love like once Batroc does kick it open, he then, you know, bows at the waist and extends his arm to invite Cap to just head on in.
He's now that a real man has opened the door for you, be my guest.
Yeah. Feel free to trigger all the traps that are on the other side of it. So they're chasing Lady S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. She activates some S.H.I.E.L.D. traps to try to stop them. But I mean, come on, it's Captain America and Batroc.
S.H.I.E.L.D. trap is like the floor is now a fun slide. It's so specifically not going to do a damn thing to Captain America or Batroc. It wouldn't kill a 6-year-old. It just makes the direction they're going more fun than it was before.
Right. Good trap. So they catch up with her and she passes out because she's suffering from Inferno 42 exposure, which, you know, is the thing I think we're all familiar with.
Sure.
It's a scourge.
You're being sarcastic, but everyone in this comic knows exactly what the fuck it is.
That's true.
These guys are like, "Oh yeah, Inferno 42, this thing that previously did not exist. I know what it does when you get exposed to it."
Right. Yeah.
I also like how this woman, again, because Stanley is so contemptuous of the thinking skills of women. She has this exposed explosive that's glowing so hard. They're following her from like miles away. They're like, "Oh, she's on the other side of like the bay." They're like, "Oh, there's the glow. Let's get after her." And she doesn't have any concern for it. She's just like, "You know, my explosive is glowing."
Like, sure, this is fine.
Probably fine. Captain America's like, "Hey, stop." She's like, "I bet you're a guy in a Captain America costume. How'd you get a Captain America costume?" That's a real thought she has, which she does not try to answer.
Yeah.
She doesn't think like, "Let me get to the answer to this question. Oh, you know what? It's possible. That's just Captain America. And he really does want me to drop this glowing explosive." No.
As Cap is trying to take care of her, Batroc grabs the Inferno 42 and he escapes. and he brings it to his shadowy employers, who have a neutralizing case to contain it. Now that is some foresight. And but then, you know, Cap shows up, and Batroc's not going to get paid until he beats up Captain America. So he's going to beat up Captain America some more.
He's going to do. Yeah, oh, I love it.
I do love Batroc kicking the shield. Like Cap throws the shield at him, and he just kicks it.
And Captain America actually beats him with like the Lucy Charlie Brown move, where he like lowers himself down to get kicked in the face, and then pulls his face out of the way, and like Batroc's like all off balance, like Charlie Brown, and that's how, then he grabs him by the foot, throws his head into the wall, and that's when Batroc is like, this guy's kicking my ass, so I gotta get out of here. Like he's got no like insecurities. No. He's just like, this guy's winning the fight, I'm leaving. I love him. I love Team Batroc. He doesn't have a ton of shame. He lost to Captain America. There's not a lot of shame in that. Captain America's the best.
Yeah.
And so he takes off.
The entire German army lost to Captain America. You're just one guy. Like, you know.
He sucks for most of this comic, but in the end, I mean, we all know Captain America. He's the best.
Yeah, his name's on the cover. So Batroc, as part of his retreat, he grabs the glowing cylinder of Inferno 42. He's not concerned about Inferno 42 exposure. And he gives it to his employers, and they take off. And Cap, rather than pursuing the guys with the Inferno 42, this deadly thing that's going to destroy a city, he doubles back to the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent because he's obsessed with figuring out who this woman is, which is not only unprofessional, but a little creepy.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the first thought for Cap isn't, this could be her daughter. It just isn't his thought at all.
Right.
Which is the logical thing. I see a girl that looks like exactly like somebody I knew 20 years ago. Just take a guess. Like, maybe they're related. Maybe it's her daughter. She probably didn't get thrown into, you know, ice for that 20 years like he did.
And probably not.
Yeah.
But he does live in a world where that's possible.
True.
Add that to the list of things that might have happened.
Or, you know, it also never crosses his mind. It's like, this is crazy. I need to get some help.
Right.
Everywhere I turn, I'm seeing people from my past who could not possibly be there.
Right.
It's like, I really should not be in action right now. I need to take a break. I need to get someone to help me out with this.
You're so thoughtful and like sympathetic.
So Cap, you know, he goes back to the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. He's thinking to himself, she was lost to me forever. Those long years ago, no matter how much I may hope or dream, nothing can ever change that. But she's got Inferno 42 poisoning, and there is no known cure for this. But at least we do learn that the bad guy's got a dummy Inferno 42 canister somehow. So the day is saved, but Cap is going to lose the mystery girl of his dreams again.
And the bad guys got away, but they didn't get the explosive.
Right.
Take a moment to think about this.
Okay.
You read it. You might have it fresh in your mind even. But what do you think Batroc's exact exiting line was? Knowing what you know about how he talks.
It's going to be au revoir, right?
Yeah.
It is au revoir, mon ami.
And then he jumps through a wall, like feet first, breaks the wall. Yeah.
So
way to
good.
Go, Stan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He should be on the Mount Rushmore of Captain America villains.
Yeah. He's the best.
There's your Captain America story for the month. We're going to take a break. When we get back, Rob, you want to, we left on a cliffhanger with the X-Men last month. You want to resolve that cliffhanger for us?
I sure do.
Awesome. All right, everybody, stay tuned. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let us find out more about the return of Magneto. This is X-Men number 17 and 18. We covered 17 last month with some interesting magnetic principles that Stan introduced, and we will do some more.
Hypnosis! He has magnetic hypnosis!
So many things.
Angel's parents come in, he's like, magnet hypnosis. They go upstairs, and their clothes turn into pajamas, unless Stan Lee has led us to believe that they came to visit their son at his school with their own pajamas. Absurd. That's magnet powers. They crawled into bed with magnet pajamas, took a nice magnet nap.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird leaps of logic in this. I mean, even by like 1960s Marvel Comics standards, there's some very strange logic at work here.
Brian and I ended up texting screenshots to each other, which we don't do a ton of during the week, but this one did warrant that.
Yeah.
This was a contender for my panel of the month, was where Professor Xavier's getting like attacked by tentacle like wires. And he says, "It's a mechanical mental wave distorter, the one type of weapon I cannot face." Motherfucker is in a wheelchair. He can't fight a frisbee. Like, he's just a...
That's so true.
If you put on a telepath-proof hat, he can't fight a stick. He can't fight a punch. A tentacle anti-telepath thing. The one thing I can't fight. I love it. I just love that that was written down.
Okay, these magical issues, written by Stan Lee, layouts by Jack Kirby, art by Jay Gavin, who is Werner Roth, with Dick Ayers doing the inking. The story is called "And None Shall Survive" was the first part, and "If Iceman Should Fail" is the second part, number 18. We covered X-Men 17 very briefly. I'll go over it. The X-Men are recovering from their battle with the Sentinels. Beast, Iceman, and Cyclops are all in the hospital, and Iceman is especially seriously injured, and they can't really help him because he's icy.
This comic actually opens with the Doctor holding Iceman's wrist and saying, "Your pulse is impossible, son." Your
pulse is impossible. That's some doctoring.
Yeah, you're a man out of ice, you dumb shit.
That's his clinical opinion. It's impossible.
It's impossible. I'd like unrelated to your ice, though. I still thought you'd have normal flowing human blood. God.
Okay. After Angel's parents announce that they're going to visit Xavier's school, Angel heads back there to intercept them and is immediately taken out by a mysterious shadowy figure. Professor X and Cyclops meet the same fate, followed by Beast and Marvel Girl. So everybody just one by one, like we were talking last episode, it's like Friday the 13th. They just let's split up and get taken out.
Angel gets taken out by a thing falling in his way, which is another great Stan Lee writing trope where someone doesn't quite have time to dodge, but they have time to think a whole lot about it or have a long discussion about how they... So he thinks, there's something in front of me. It suddenly dropped into place. I'm going to hit it.
And it...
Amazing.
We talked about this last episode too, but it's kind of sad. It's like him flying into a window, basically. It's like a mirror. So it just seems like
he's like, that guy's got the powers of a pigeon.
Right. So let's
kill a pigeon.
That's it.
It's genius in a way.
Yeah.
It's like how Batman would take out a guy who could fly. It's so perfectly clinical.
Just clean all the windows and stand there and wait for the guy to come. By the end of the issue, Iceman is the only X-Man who's still free. But he's in a coma at the hospital. Magneto has captured all the rest of them. When Angel's parents arrive at the school at the very end is where we find out it is Magneto with this insane look. And then we get into, let's visit the last time we saw Magneto. He and Toad had been abducted by the Stranger in X-Men number 11. And how did he escape? Read on, True Believer. So X-Men 18 starts with Professor...
I'm going to take a wild guess. Magnet powers.
Probably. There are some serious magnet powers, some involving metal even. Yeah,
I was gonna say, I think his escape is the only time he actually uses his magnet power and anything metal in the entire story. True.
They're normally very, very ill-defined magnet powers. Yeah. But here he's like, I'm gonna move that metal onto that metal.
Yep. Pretty straightforward.
Then start the atomic drive with my magnet powers. I'm like, now we're back into some pretty...
It's electromagnetic. Professor X, all the X-Men, they're trapped in a metal sphere that's attached to a balloon that's floating into the atmosphere.
Because even though he has magnetic powers and, you know, total control over all matter and could just, you know, kill them instantly.
Yeah, he could just shoot that ball into space or kill them.
Right,
with...
because his intention is to kill them.
Yeah, he absolutely wants... I think he... like deep down he doesn't though. I mean, like he could have easily killed them, obviously. And to send them shooting into the sky where like seven or eight different applications of their powers could easily get them out of
right.
Like all they have to do is stop being fucking idiots for like half a second.
Right. Fine. I mean, a guy can shoot lasers out of his eyes and another guy has wings. They could probably put something together here.
Right. And the other one can literally levitate.
Right. Yep.
And whatever. Beast is kind of screwed. But like, one of the others could carry him.
Right.
How many times have you seen Cyclops fall out of a plane, slowing down his fall with his optic blast?
Sure.
Like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Like that's, I think he'll think of that during the 4 mile fall.
Yeah, he'll figure
anyway.
It out.
Anyway.
So back at the X mansion, after Magneto has, you know, let them lift into space, he lifts into the air and almost destroys the whole mansion with his magnetic power before thinking. So you can see the mansion in the air, stuff dangling under it.
Yeah, the plumbing is
plumbing, electrical gone, sewage just everywhere. So he puts it back and sort of walks through and fixes things with some magical magnetic power.
Yeah, he tidies everything up. It's great.
Yeah, it's like fine. It's just he just has to think of it. He greets Angel's parents. They arrive and he uses magnetic attraction to hypnotize them into going to sleep upstairs. So that's all creepy. Yeah,
it's like the play on words became like magically a superpower. It's like attraction. You know, that could mean a second thing. Done. It's a power.
I have another comic to write, so that's it. Yeah.
It's like a fairy tale idea of a power. You know what I mean? Like I just love it. I love how stupid it is and how like it opens the door to all kinds of like nonlinear thinking in this sci-fi world that should have some sort of a pseudoscience backing it. It's like I think he's being clever here, or he thinks he's being clever here.
He's been writing X-Men for 2 years at this point. He still does not understand how magnetism works.
Maybe he held a magnet once, and during that time, just all kinds of weird shit started happening around him, and something went wrong in his brain, and he thought, this magnet did all of that.
Yeah. It was coated in LSD was the problem. So so back at the hospital, there is some crazy experimental science going on to try and save Iceman's life.
This is the new laser-induced hypodermic.
Yeah.
And the doctor says, quickly, woman, is the new laser-induced hypodermic ready? She does not address that. She does not say, I will not be spoken to like this.
No. There's like, no agency.
Sorry, doctor.
Yeah. This seems reasonable.
Yeah, it's Mad Men, basically. Also, the laser-induced hypodermic is going to inject him with a new sulfa drug.
Sulfa drug.
It's to, like, that's to take care of, like, a bacterial infection. They were fighting Sentinels, so it's like, yeah, with the Sentinels just, like, leaving really unsanitary things that's around it, like, happens, yeah. Probably he got like sepsis from something.
So meanwhile, Professor X is waking up inside of the metal sphere. He gives some double talk explanation for how he's able to break free of the mental wave distorter.
Yeah, he just thinks really hard.
Yeah.
And it goes kabak and it explodes on his head.
Yeah.
Meaning the one weapon that he says he can't deal with.
Right.
He deals with using his
power.
One power.
Yeah.
So by Stanley logic, that means Professor X cannot be defeated by any weapon. Keep that in mind.
Yep. Well, I mean, he basically is the reason he solves every battle that the X-Men ever fight up until this point in X-Men. So like he basically is, he has no weaknesses. He's the only person on the team who's like competent enough to actually be able to solve problems. But the explanation he gives for why he's able to use his mental powers to defeat this thing is just absolutely insane, even again by Stan standards. Like he says, but even he has overlooked one basic item. My ability to read minds and project my thoughts is due to the counter ego which I possess. Even now, that same counter ego is probing the distorter, applying as much stress and strain to it as is humanly possible. A, you're not a human, and B, again, like,
wait, is this that little old lady that lived inside Xavier? Is that in the Grant Morrison?
Oh, yeah.
What's her name?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Cassandra Nova. That's what he's talking about. That's Cassandra Nova did that.
There you go.
That's a well planted seed.
That was Stan planting seeds.
I'm not retconning. We just read it. We just read the seed of Cassandra Nova. That's good.
Incredible.
He can see so far into the future. The threads are.
Yeah.
He's just weaving a world, knowing exactly where it's headed. Yeah.
8D chess. What I also love is Professor Xavier is screaming his thoughts out loud. He's like, the pain is increasing by the second. But like, he's trapped in a bubble. He could like roll onto one of his friends and scream in their ear, wake up. pull this off my head.
He does have the use of his arms. He can,
yeah,
you know, shake somebody.
He's not tied up very tightly at all.
No. And then we get back to the X-Mansion. Magneto is assembling a machine that will allow him to create new mutants somehow.
He hooks it up to Angel's parents. Like, the thing he's looking for this all these years was the parents of a mutant.
Yep.
That's all he needed to create instantly a machine that creates super army soldiers.
Yeah.
It's the fucking best.
And he's known a lot of mutants already. I mean, he had a brotherhood of evil mutants, so he probably could have grabbed one of their parents at some point.
Any of those guys could have had parents, but apparently they didn't. But what I love is, like, the genetic code of their parents seems like it would be, like, less potent than, like, the genetic code of a guy who could control magnets.
Yeah.
I just don't get it. They're like a couple of rich people who accidentally had a kid with wings.
Yeah.
And he's like, inside them is the secret to green super androids. Don't they want to take 6 minutes to incubate these things? These things are good to go right now.
Yeah. And he is also, I don't know if he's demonstrated this level of engineering prowess before, but he's made like this thing to sit over them. And
this is full Dr. Doom level.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So he's built a scanner that analyzes Angel's parents, their cells, and unlocks whatever causes them to give birth to a mutant. So it's this, like big lamp with a tube, you know, that's over them in beds in their, magnetically created pajamas.
In separate beds,
of course. So at the hospital, Iceman finally comes to because Professor X is yelling at him in his brain.
Wake up.
And he escapes through
your pulse is impossible, but I need you to wake up.
And he is still pretty messed up, but he escapes through the window and heads for the mansion on his normal, you know, ice slides and things.
I want to talk about this real quick.
Yeah, go for it.
Cyclops and Professor X drove there, and it very clearly says it took an hour of like hard driving. So we're assuming Angel took less time because he's faster than a car and he can go as the crow flies. But then Beast and Marvel Girl get there by just jumping and floating. So they almost certainly took longer than an hour. So Magneto he is here like for 3 days, just like waiting for the X-Men to slowly arrive from across the state.
Yeah. That's why he's able to build these elaborate traps and plans. He's just like, that's, I got true. Nothing but time.
So much time.
Now I'm trying to imagine what Magneto was doing in the downtime, like when he needed a break, just sort of strolling around the mansion.
He probably hatched this whole scheme like during the downtime. God, when are they going to get here? Are they seriously jumping here from Westchester?
I can't keep these kids' parents asleep forever. Wait, maybe I can. Wait, maybe I can make mutants out of these people.
Oh my God, I got to try it. I got all these lamps. I'm going to try it.
I'm just going to build this.
I think this stupid kid is working. This is how I like built fireworks when I was a kid too. I'm like, there's no way this is going to work. Oh my God, it works.
any other version, it just like melts his parents into the bed and that's that, the end of the Worthingtons, but somehow they're still there. So Marvel Girl is still trying to force the balloon back to Earth. She's basically just looking at the bottom of the metal sphere they're in very hard.
It's the most visually thrilling power ever.
And that's the perfect Stan Lee like explanation of how her obvious solution doesn't work. She's like, oh, now, you know, I can't stop it from floating up. All I can do is halt our progress.
Right. So
with my fantastic powers, they don't work on balloons in both directions.
So then as Professor X is sitting in the metal sphere, he scans Magneto's mind. It's so weird.
He can't scan Magneto's mind. His hat prevents that.
Yep.
This is some bullshit.
But apparently somehow he can, because of the duress, let's just say Professor X is so.
He got in through the face part. He always forgets. He left that face part open.
Right in through the nostril. Like a lobotomy, which is what also Professor X is good at. But so he escaped from the stranger. And it's really simple. This is what Professor X learns from Magneto's brain. The stranger's entire planet is basically a giant museum. So that's when Magneto, he just sort of hotwires a rocket, builds a ladder with his magnet powers, and then leaves the toad. What a jerk.
For no reason. He's like, Master, let me come. This would be great. No, fuck you. What? Why?
You just no suck. Reason. Bye, Toad. Yeah.
That was maybe my favorite part of the entire story, was just totally dismissing the Toad. Like,
he's like, do you have your parents' phone number, Toad? What? No. Well, then you're useless to me and my plans.
And he's just left on the zoo museum of the stranger. Yeah. Then Iceman finally makes it across town from the hospital in
four and a half days later,
near death state. Yeah. He arrives at the mansion just as Magneto is starting to create his first batch of mutants in his magnet tubes. Iceman covers Angel's parents with an ice shield to stop the process. So,
I'm sure this was covered in the danger room.
If you were making a machine that sucked people's DNA through the open air, and some asshole walked into your lab and dropped 400 pounds of ice on the floor, you'd be like, dude, that really fucks up my experiment.
Yeah, not cool.
How was I supposed to know 400 pounds of ice screws up your clone machine? It's kind of common sense. So I buy it, is my point.
Okay.
I think this would disrupt whatever Magneto is doing.
This is good science. It's solid science. So Magneto attacks Iceman. And Iceman escapes on an ice slide. That's what he does.
You're going to just skip over how Magneto says, I'll destroy you with a gesture. Every object in the room will become a deadly threat. And he throws a phone, a radio, a radiator, and a clock. That is
every object.
He has literally limitless powers in every direction. He's like, I'm going to throw a clock at this. And he's bragging about it. Yeah. He's not like, a paltry demonstration of my powers will destroy. He's like, no, imagine the most cool thing in the world, and I'm about to do it. Clock throw.
I'm going to throw a phone at a guy who's made of solid ice. That'll sort him out.
With an impossible pulse. The clock wouldn't even be able to detect his pulse. It's that impossible.
And keep in mind, Magneto lifted the whole building they're in earlier in the issue. Lifted it, put it back, fixed all the plumbing with his mind, but then he throws a clock at
Iceman. They use the word melt at least twice in this comic where he's going to melt him with his magnet.
Yep.
So like throwing a clock is by far the least useful application of his ability when fighting a man made out of ice.
Yep. So Magneto has no choice but to follow Iceman down his ice slide.
Which looks a lot like fun.
Yeah,
it's like a hydro.
Are you telling me you wouldn't? Yeah. Are you telling me you'd be like, oh, I'm not taking ice?
No, I'd go head first, like straight
head
in.
First. Yeah, that's true.
Iceman had this great plan. He had built an ice igloo where this slide feeds into in order to trap Magneto.
Put him in an igloo. That should do it, right? Yep.
So
I just escaped an outer space planet. He's like, you know what his powers probably will work on though.
An igloo.
And you know that, like, going through Iceman's head, he's thinking, it's like, I'm just going to trap him in an ice igloo. His magnetic powers can't work on ice.
They can't work on ice. It's not magnetic.
But it is, because Magneto instantly seals the igloo, the ice dome, with his magnetic powers. So we now know that magnets can make pajamas and they work on ice.
And I think this is kind of a big deal to seal an igloo with magnets, because he says, now you shall feel the power of Magneto as few have ever felt it before. So to him, this is an unprecedented level of magnet power to close this igloo.
Well, and I also think it's a reflection of how unusual it is that you would ever be in an ice igloo with Magneto. You know, I mean, it's like only two or three other people in the world have ever experienced that.
Putting Magneto in an igloo is your first mistake. Getting inside it with him is your last mistake.
Okay, so this is still going. This is a comic of...
Yeah.
It's deep.
It's dense.
So meanwhile, high above the surface of the Earth, Cyclops pokes a hole in a balloon with his force beam.
Takes him 15 pages to finally think.
Yeah. I'm the guy who shoots lasers out of my eyes. I'm going to shoot lasers out of my eyes.
Yeah. And then, of course, he needs help. Professor X guides him to, the pinpoint
shoot
spot.
Shoot the right spot. Because it's dead.
Cyclops, up is that way.
Got it.
And then Marvel Girl is able to slow the falling sphere just enough to help them land safely. All she could do is just keep it from going up until they're getting close to the ground. And then she can really, it's something about the ground, I'm guessing.
The excuse for not blowing a hole in it earlier was because they were so high that oxygen would escape. So presumably as they got lower, they could just blow a hole and like Angel could take turns flying him down. There's literally, if you gave me a piece of paper and a pencil, I could write you 70 ways the X-Men get out of this. No trouble. At 6 years old, I could have come up with 100. Now maybe 50. I had a more vivid imagination back then. But I'm just saying, this is so stupid. And it's such an easy predicament for these particular people to escape. And Magneto probably should have known that, because like, he tried to kill this one guy like you'd kill a pigeon. Like he knows these people inside and out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He knows their strengths and weaknesses. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'll float them into sky. Yeah, but two of them fly, dumb shit. They couldn't carry all three of the others, right? No, it's crazy.
And the only way that Professor X manages to save the day, of course, is by telepathically reaching out to the stranger across the galaxy. And the stranger shows up looking like a pissed off space Chinese dragon. Magneto hightails it with the stranger in hot pursuit.
Magneto's Magna car was nearby. He's gone. His Magna car. He saw the stranger and he says, the only way to outrun interdimensional super gods is the Magna car.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Not even the rocket that he stole to get to Earth. But no, he had like a separate car.
Iceman then shuts down Magneto's machine. So just in time, because we were about to get some of the mutants made from the same DNA that made Warren Worthington III.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, these things probably had souls. These were probably Warren's like brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And they just died.
Yep.
Yeah, this is a very anti-pro-life message. Yeah.
These are their people too. These are like mutants had no one else to love them but the X-Men, and they're like, no.
And this is, I mean, there's not a lot of mutants in the world right now. So, I mean, this is like the first mutant genocide.
They could have tripled the size of the X-Men right here.
Yeah, I mean, it's nature and nurture, right? I mean, couldn't they have just raised them to be like helpful and productive members of mutant society? They didn't even try.
But they were tainted by that magnetism.
Also, they're referred to as the android mutants. on the very last page, the android mutants, they vanished, faded away to nothingness. That's not what an android is.
Yeah, it's all very strange. It's like they glued this plot to the other. Like Magneto came there to kill the X-Men, and Stan's like, you know, let's add like another element to it. What if he's also, I don't know, taking the DNA of the winged guy's parents and making androids out of it? Oh, I'm the only one in the room? There's no voice of reason to say that's fucking crazy, Stan Lee?
Done.
Okay, it's in.
That is the epic tale of Magneto taking over the mansion for a while and getting foiled for a bit by an igloo and then a space dragon.
There might not be a dumber death trap or dumber villainous plot like in the history of this genre. It's so dumb. Like Super Friends plots are not this dumb.
Yeah. No, we've read. So for the podcast, we read almost 400 issues of Marvel Comics, like early 60s Marvel Comics. And I think this is like one of the top 10 most absurd issues that we have ever read. It's way high up there. It's definitely. And if you take out all the Larry Lieber stuff and leave only the Stan Lee stuff, this might be number one.
That is X-Men number 17 and 18.
Congratulations.
We should probably take a break.
Yeah, I think so. Let's take a break and then come back and talk about Fantastic Four. Let's get a little Galactus Silver Surfer action.
We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month.
No, see, you don't need to edit this. Leave that in. Let them know I got the better of you. Show them my domination.
All right, Batroc. all right. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We've had a change in plans during the break. We are going to talk about Thor versus Hercules in Thor number 126, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, and inked by Vince Coletta. This one's called Whom the Gods Would Destroy. And the other thing that's special about this issue, it's the very first issue of Thor. This is the first issue where Journey into Mystery becomes Thor.
And they just get to keep the number, which is pretty cool. It's Thor number 126.
Yes, exactly.
And Mystery, I'm afraid you've been let go.
No more Mystery.
Nope. Here's the backstory for what we're about to talk about. So Thor has revealed his secret identity as Lame Dr. Blake to Jane Foster. Odin, not happy about it. Jane is not happy that Thor slash Blake keeps ghosting on her because, you know, secret identity stuff. Mm-hmm. She runs into Hercules, decides to make Thor jealous, and it works. They get into a big fight. So there's the setup for the issue.
Stanley writing mature and thoughtful women once again. What would a woman do here? Oh, I bet she'd do some sort of conniving bully to make a man mad.
That's it.
Oh, man. So, yeah. So this is great. I mean, the thing that I love about this issue is it's just a big, like, 15-page long Jack Kirby fight. Like, yeah. It's just two tough guys.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Two tough guys with blunt objects hitting each other, hitting the blunt objects against each other. Like smashing trucks into each other. It's phenomenal.
While astonished people look on with Stanley word bubbles filling their mouths with the dumbest joke. Like, here they are just bashing weapons together. This guy's like, never mind that. Does my store insurance cover damage by immortals? This guy should be having his face ripped off by shockwaves and he's here like doing Flintstones jokes.
That truck squishing thing, it's a three panel page, and the middle panel is just Hercules pushing on the front of a truck that mm-hmm. has like two trailers on it. So this is a tractor trailer, and Thor in the back just pushing the other way, and they yeah. just
it's just crumpled
and yeah. just like mutilated. Gone. Yeah,
that's the level of power these guys are throwing at each other, and there's people 3 to 4 feet away from them.
Yeah, totally fine. Yeah,
they do address that in that Stanley way of saying like, okay, Thor's being very careful not to hit anybody. Like, for example, Hercules thinks his hammer returned to him, passing over the heads of the mortal assemblage. they got to keep reminding the reader, like, nobody's dying here. Relax.
Yep. He spends a lot of time making sure that Thor is making it clear that he's trying not to kill anyone. He spends right. almost no time with Hercules doing the same. Like, Hercules does not care.
He keeps saying stuff like that, too. Like, I do not care about anything except kicking your ass. Thor's yeah.
like, where I come from, mortals are just... You know, they're like dirt. Just whatever happens, happens. It's yeah. fine.
This kind of wrecked me when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up country around Christians. So I sort of didn't know there was like an option to not be that. And so a comic where like two different mythologies had dudes here really like created an existential crisis in like 6-year-old me where I'm like, does that mean like the regular God is in this too? And like, why isn't he an Avenger? Like,
yeah,
like it's hard to reconcile like that. The idea that all of the other gods exist, but not like the one that is like the real one.
Right. That's
obviously is absurd.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
I went through the same problem and we talked about it. Like I think the first thing that broke my brain was when Eternity, the Ditko version of Eternity showed up in right. Doctor Strange. And I was like, okay, what?
The Christian God would live in Eternity, right?
Yeah.
he's bigger than the regular Christian God. It's just, it's a lot to think about for a young child. The people in Marvel Universe are Christians. Like, it takes place seemingly in our world. Like, Daredevil's a Catholic, and he talks about that all the time.
Right.
And so you can't even say, like, oh, this takes place in a universe where the regular God isn't there. It's like, no. Like, the Greek yeah. gods are just, like, way cooler than your stupid Christian God. They can come down and have fist fights with Thor.
Yeah.
That's really embarrassing for a young Christian boy.
Yeah, it does mess with the mind. This definitely started my long journey of other religious exploration, like mythology, and then into like Buddhism and then whatever else. But yeah, comics can poison your mind if you're
I think the poisoning of the mind happened before the comic. The poisoning of the mind was what made the comic less enjoyable.
Oh man. Yeah, and God, the fight stuff in this, we read so many of these things that I tend to gloss over a lot of the fight stuff in a lot of these just because I'm like, okay, we got to hit the plot beats. We got to summarize this stuff. But this is just, it's an orgy of violence. It's just wonderful yeah. to behold. Like, you got the truck squishing scene on page 4. And then on like page 6, they're like fighting on top of a train.
It's great. They do all these sets and they answer a lot of questions that I think I had when I was a kid, because mm-hmm. you look at Thor and Hercules, like, okay, they're the same strength, but Thor's hammer is just this amazing thing.
Yeah.
And Hercules just has like a little stick. And they even explain that, like, Hercules is like, his enchanted hammer makes a living mockery of mine own mace. And so you're like, okay, they addressed it.
Yeah. And then like all good fights between two super strong guys, it winds up in a construction yard. Yes. Yeah. And then, so, you know, you got like heavy equipment being thrown, giant tires, tractor treads and cranes and all sorts of wonderful nonsense.
I'd like to read what they say to each other when they get to the construction site.
Please
do. Hercules says, "Now here, on this site where aged buildings are being demolished, we can reach our ultimate moment of truth with none to interfere." And then Thor gives the perfect response, "Your hunger for battle is disease, and the hammer of Thor shall supply the cure." These guys are fucking awesome.
Yes.
Is my point.
Yep.
This is why we have action movie lines from then on, you know.
They spent the whole fight just telling each other how fucking rad they are. They're like, "Oh, you're so strong, but I'm stronger." "No, I'm stronger. I'm gonna fucking kick your ass. God, I love how you want to kick my ass."
That's a good summary.
And then, like, right in the middle of the story is just like a full page splash of Thor just decking Hercules in the face.
He tries to whip him with bulldozer treads.
Yeah.
And Hercules loves it. He says, "Ha, using the steel tread of a vehicle as a whip against Hercules, a brilliant stratagem, Thunder God." They just appreciate the majesty of what they're doing so much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, they're both totally into it. They're having the time of their lives.
On page 11, this is my favorite. It's always my favorite when somebody just picks up a building and drops it on somebody. That's how you illustrate power. So yep. Hercules picks up a full brick, I don't know, 3-4 story building.
Yep.
And drops it on Thor.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And I love that there's a pro wrestling element of like not wanting to give anyone a clean win. Like they know that like they can't have one of these guys clean win. So they have, of course, Odin take away half of Thor's power. Am I skipping ahead?
Oh no, that's right actually there. What I was just about to get to. So in the like beginning of the last half of the story, yeah, so Odin's watching all of this. He's still seething because Thor violated his order to not reveal his identity to Jane Foster. So he's been brooding about what the punishment's going to be. And so Odin decides that he's going to remove half of Thor's power. This is not the first time he's done this. This is a thing Odin does every now and then, usually Jane Foster related. And then actually he gets his flunky Seedring to do it. Like he can't even bring himself to do it. Like we've seen this like with our friend Noah mentioned this about Odin can't punish Loki either. Like he's the dad who talks tough, but like he never actually backs it up. And his kids are just going to turn out crappy because, you know, he doesn't really lay down the law. He's a lot of bluster. So
it seems really dangerous to give the Odin power to this other guy too.
Yeah.
Seems like sort of a dick. And he's like, "You know, I can't do it. Here's all of my omnipotent God power.
Yep.
Just, I want you to take away half his power and then give it right back. I don't want you fucking around with it." That seems like that should have spun off into something terrible.
Yeah. And maybe it will. I don't know.
Maybe it will. Maybe.
Yeah. Seedring has all the distinctive looks of a evil Jack Kirby guy. He's got very pointy facial hair. He's got a very long face. Dead eyes, like
cosmic antlers.
Yep. So yeah, he's probably going to turn out to be not great. So Thor loses half his powers and all of a sudden he's not having nearly as much fun.
Here's my favorite thing about Thor is he's an idiot. And I actually wrote an article on Cracked. Google it. Superheroes that are very stupid. I can't remember what title we called it, but a lot of it is about Thor and how stupid he is. And right here, when he loses half his power, he thinks, "Mayhap when strength has departed, natural cunning yet may serve." And let me tell you, the very next thing Thor does in this fight is pick up a giant car, and then, since it's so heavy, he drops it on himself. That's the first thing he does when he says, "I gotta think smart."
Yep.
He drops a car on himself the very next move. That's how fucking dumb Thor is.
That's not much of a fight after that. Hercules just deals with him.
Yeah, but half of a Thor is still five Spider-Mans.
Sure.
I mean, it's still very, very strong. It's still a Drax the Destroyer.
Right.
It's still 5/7 of a thing. Like, it's still pretty strong. And if we're really talking about Thor being cunning, his hammer can transport things to other dimensions.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's an outrageous object of cosmic power. He can melt the ground underneath Hercules, send him to the Earth's core, sealing it up behind him. There's no limit to the number of things Thor could do in terms of cunning. And he picks up a truck and drops it on himself.
And then he can't get out from under the truck. So Hercules kicks the truck off of him so he can keep beating him up.
Out of pity. I'm not going to let you die like this. Can you imagine the grave Thor lived for 25 million years and then died by dropping a truck on himself after he could only lift 50 tons?
Yep.
Like, and then to make matters worse, like, everyone makes fun of Thor. They're like, Thor, you lost a fist fight, you piece of shit.
They turn on him so quick.
Exactly. And Thor loses all self-esteem. He's like, oh, I'm not even worthy of being Thor. He throws away his relationship with Jane Foster. He's just like, you need a better guy than me. I can only lift 50 tons. I lost a fist fight to Hercules. I'm no man. He just gives up on everything.
Yeah.
And yet while he's doing this, Odin's like, yeah, he went out big like a god. Like he like says, like, no, he didn't.
It's the bit at the very end. So after he tells Jane, it's like, look, until I make up for this grievous loss of honor, I can't have anything to do with you. I'm not worthy of you. Right. And then Odin appears at like a pair of floating ghostly eyes behind Jane. And he's like, hey, Thor didn't lose that fight. I made him lose that fight. That's on me. But he's going to need you. So even though I don't want him hanging out with you, go after him and like help out. Like just a lot of mixed messages.
And what is Thor's fight record now? Like 75 million and one? Like he's doing okay. He's like, oh, I'm on our list. Like, I think you can get this one back, Thor.
Yeah. Although I think it's just like, it's one of those, I think the first one just hurts the most. Like,
I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But you've never lost a fight. So, you know.
Yeah. I wouldn't even know what that feels like.
We didn't even know what that feels like. So.
I've never tripped. I've never woken up with a hangover. I don't understand what true suffering is.
No, not at all.
So I can relate to Thor just giving up at the first sign of it. As a comic reader, that's what I want to see my heroes do.
That's what gets you coming back for the next issue. All right, cool. Well, there you go. There's your Thor for the month.
I'm glad I talked into Thor. I really think we saved some lives with that.
I think we did some good work there. So let's go ahead and take our final break. And then when we come back, I promise this time, we're going to talk about Fantastic Four number 49.
I've actually got 12 more issues of Thor I'd like to discuss when we come back.
All right, we'll be right back on Marvel by the Month. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We got one issue left to talk about. It's Fantastic Four number 49, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inked by Joe Sinnott. If this be doomsday, it is the second part of the three-part Coming of Galactus storyline. In last issue, Galactus arrived and he's hungry. So this issue begins on top of the Baxter Building with the Watcher trying to convince Galactus not to eat the Earth as the Fantastic Four looks on.
Terrible Watcher. Just getting in the middle of all of this.
Yeah, so he's already intervening. I mean, this is not passive observation. So they're talking for a while. Galactus is not buying what the Watcher's selling. So Ben loses patience and slugs Galactus in the leg. And Galactus barely even seems to notice it. He just drops some kind of like cosmic insect repellent.
Drops a bug bomb on him.
It's so good. Like the sense of like the irrelevance of the Fantastic Four in this issue is fantastic.
It only gets worse too.
It does. Like they're so obviously out of their league from start to finish in this entire story. So then like Reed has to like wrap up Ben and roll away with him so he doesn't inhale the whatever is in the bug
like
bomb.
A sleeping bag and rolls away.
Yep.
The standard procedure to escape a chemical attack.
Yeah. Stop, drop, and roll up your friend.
Like it went off in his face. Like if it's going to kill him, he's dead. He's right, like, yuck. That's his reaction. Yuck. What is it? What in the blazes is happening? It's just such a thing reaction to getting space poison in your lungs.
It's worth saying too, since last issue, Galactus changed into it's like a sort of a burgundy and purple outfit. Right. But last issue was just full Christmas tree, green and red.
Yeah, his color scheme was totally different in the first time he shows up at the end of the last issue.
I do like the short sleeves and like the exposed legs in this version of Galactus.
Yeah. He's getting some sun, you know.
He suns out, guns out. And in the next issue, he's going to have long pants. So like Kirby is like actively working to figure out Galactus's costume.
Yeah. I do think he nails it. Like, I think Galactus is one of the greatest costumes like in the history of comics. Like totally. I love Galactus's costume. He looks so cool. I used to draw it all the time when I was a kid. And every time I'd just be amazed at the weird details that Kirby could hide and stuff that he did that just didn't make sense until you tried to draw it yourself.
Yes.
And then they made that Fantastic Four movie. and they made him like a cloud.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, no one will ever make a worse decision than that. Like, nothing will ever be adapted so poorly as someone seeing Galactus and thinking, what if it was like a cloud? It was kind of cute that the bugs sort of looked like his hat.
Yeah,
I guess, but that's it. That's the like, most that's the nicest thing I can say. It's like, it's kind of cute.
It's basically the George Lucas Ewok decision. Yeah, let's just let's put something cute in here.
So Ben's out of the picture. Reed's out of the picture. The Torch also tries and fails to take Galactus out again. And
kudos to Torch for knowing exactly what happened to him. Where he says, "Ugh, he's made the actual electrons in my flame contract just by looking at me."
Yeah. Well, you know, he hangs out with the world's smartest guy, so he just it's absorbs rubbing off the stuff on him,
for sure. From, yeah. He might not even be right. That's another thing we should consider.
And it wasn't that at all.
He might have just hit him with a space fire extinguisher.
Yeah.
He's got a bug bomb and a fire extinguisher just in case he runs into the Fantastic Four. And Human Torch is like, oh, he must have discharged my electrons and changed the circular array of their atomic weight. They're like, no, dude. You got hit by a fire extinguisher.
Don't give yourself too much credit, kid.
Yeah. That guy can. He barely goes to high school. Like, right. You know.
Yeah. So after all this tomfoolery, the Watcher basically tells them, just go away. There's nothing you can do right now. This is, you know. So Johnny heads inside where Ben is already taking a bath and Reed is shaving.
No one has given a part of him this. He's fucking shaving.
Yeah.
They just said they called it. They're like, whatever's going on out there, we can't do shit about it. Yeah. Go shave. They're like reading. They're like starting a VHS tape.
But
what's
again,
this blasted machine, Stretch? It's a VHS tape. It won't be on the commercial market for 20 years. That's fantastic. We can watch all our blasted favorite films.
But again, like just the illustration of just how outclassed the Fantastic Four are. It's like they got nothing better to do than take a bath and shave while the world's about to get eaten.
It's the greatest. The idea that they wrote it and they drew it. And no one said, like, we should not have our heroes just give up in the middle of a life-threatening event to go home and, like, clean up and have a nice night.
But meanwhile, across town, we cut to the Silver Surfer, who's lying in a heap on a rooftop where Ben punched him to last issue. And the Surfer just sort of falls through the skylight into the apartment below, which just so happens to be Alicia Masters' apartment.
What?
In a convenient twist of fate. And she is totally fascinated by him, and she's trying to make sense of this weird, well, she can't tell he's silver, but she can tell he's very smooth.
She can tell he's lonely from touching his weird, smooth head.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. That's phrenology.
I'm an amateur phrenologist. You seem really lonely, and from the planet Zen La. Am I feeling a Zen La?
I'm feeling Zen La in that, yeah.
Zenla, is someone in this crowd is from Zenla.
I'm getting a Shala, Shama, Shamala, Shalabal.
So here's what's great. he's already like learning of Earth love just from like getting a space pod at.
Yep.
Nothing is better than when she like gives him a bottle of milk and he says, "Hungry? Eat." Can it be that you actually consume these foreign morsels? Galactus is right. The mysteries of the universe are truly without limit. Like, they're sitting around, Surfer's like, do you think somewhere out there is, like, drinking food? And Galactus says, anything is possible, Harold. The world is a limitless wonder, which I eat. And he's from a planet, like, before he was coated in this silver shit, he was just a regular guy who presumably ate and peed.
Yeah.
And made sweet love to Shalabal. And here he is just like, milk, Galactus was right. The world is amazing.
Also, to pull the like, now I've seen everything line when right. It's just like milk.
He picks up her apartment. He's like, look, I can just turn this into energy and eat it. You know what? Your sculptures, your pictures, your furniture. I can eat all this shit. She's a sculptor. He falls into her house and starts eating her sculptures. And she's still like, what a truly wonderful thing you must be. No, get the fuck out of my home and stop eating my furniture.
So then we head back to the roof of the Baxter Building. Galactus is assembling his planet devouring machine, which is just another wonderful, huge Kirby machine.
I had a friend call it the space blender once. I thought that was nice.
That's exactly what it looks like.
And I love they sort of cut to like the potential of it with this sort of like this empty ocean with like dolphins and whales and octopuses like crawling around through this barren desert like they didn't have to draw that. That's above and beyond.
Oh yeah. Well, that's how the Watcher stops them from going back at Galactus by saying, "Let me tell you a little story about what exactly is going to happen to your planet." Right. And yeah,
it's can like, I wait till after I'm done shaving, please?
So yeah, it shows like all the oceans being boiled away, and then you know just like Earth being utterly desiccated. Like the shot of the planet with no oceans, just like floating in space, is just so grim. So the FF, they get this vision of what's going to happen to the planet. They are completely freaked out, but the Watcher has a plan to reassure them. He says there's a machine. It can save the human race, but it's not on Earth, and only the Human Torch can get it because the Watcher can't interfere.
He can't get it himself. Right. He can't pick up the remote control.
So the Watcher is just a very lazy person. And yeah, he's like, you want your planet not to get eaten? You're going to have to go get this thing yourself. I can't be bothered.
But I will send you, you know, with my magic power.
Right. I'll call you a cab.
Like the other Watchers are going to go, hey, did you send Human Torch to get the ultimate nullifier? And he's like, well, maybe, but I didn't touch it. Chick and mate, Uatu.
There's also literally no consequences for him ever breaking his oath. So it's like, there's no stakes in this. Like he's
what are they going to do? Come over and like watch him really hard?
Right. It's like, what are you going to do? You'd have to interfere with me to stop me from interfering. So stop hitting yourself.
So keep watching.
Yeah. So then we cut back to Alicia's apartment. And this is where the Silver Surfer goes at his evaporating spree.
just kills her apartment.
he evaporates the meal. Then a bunch of her other stuff to convert it into energy. And that's how he breaks the news to her that Galactus is going to eat her planet.
And she instantly jumps into action. She's like, okay, I got to save the planet with an impassioned plea.
Right.
And and it works.
It totally
works. Three panels later, the Silver Surfer's like, you know, you convinced me.
Yeah.
Like he has never talked to a single creature on any of these planets Galactus ate.
Exactly. It's like it's occurring to him for the first time that maybe eating people's worlds isn't cool.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Because it's not really a great speech that she gives. It's not like Stan Lee's capable of writing a moving speech that like would change your perspective on the world. It's just like, oh, we're humans. We want to like feel. So we're just like, oh my God, it's really getting through to me.
Oh yeah. Feeling. Okay. Wow. Right. Yeah. I got it.
He says, I've never heard such words, such courage, or known this strange feeling, this new emotion. At last I know. Beauty. And he's pawing at her face, like, which, when you don't have genitals, that's like third base.
Speaking of that, that's Barb's main concern. I showed her a couple of panels, and she's like, what's the deal with no bulge on that guy? Wasn't he a guy before he got silver? And I was like, Comics Code Authority took his bulge, neutered him.
He made him tuck before they coated him in cosmic power. I will be your herald. Very well. But first you must tuck. What? And I will erase all memories of food.
This is a very strange and specific set of conditions.
Galactus just likes what he likes, you know?
Anyway. God. Okay. So we cut back to Galactus. He's ready to plug in the Earth eating machine. When he does, nothing happens because Ben is on top of it, smashing it up, which he's found something he can smash.
Yeah.
He's back.
He took a bath. Yeah. He's ready to go.
Yep. he's washed the bug spray and the stink of defeat off of himself. And then I love this. So he smashes Galactus with his own machine. And then he grabs Reed, who's rolled himself up into a ball, and hucks Reed at Galactus.
And where does he hit him? Any referee would call that a dick shot.
Galactus is wearing a tiny skirt, too, so it's pretty clear where that's hitting. So Galactus, he falls off the building, but then stops himself because he's Galactus. And it's like, now, like, Galactus has finally gotten annoyed. Like, he's beyond, like, bug spray and fire extinguisher territory. So he summons the Punisher from his orbiting ship. And this is not the Punisher whose logo is displayed unironically by racist cops. He's a weird little Kirby monster who's just constantly ready to throw down.
He's like a little frogman.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's like a frogman inside of, like a man-at-arms suit.
Yeah, he sort of looks like the Destroyer, that Thor robot.
Yep.
But with frog feet and like, you know,
He's got frog headlights on. He's a frog monster.
Yeah. So then Johnny wants to join the fight. The Watcher tells him that he's got to find the machine that can save Earth. So he zaps Johnny with a time-space distortion device, sends him hurtling through the cosmos.
Doesn't sound like watching to me.
No, this is that is definitely an active decision. Johnny zips through celestial barriers of unlife and passes through the final dimensional curtain, which brings him to Galactus's home.
I should say, I like this this version of Uatu, where he sort of just looks like sort of a doughy, like, Greek philosopher.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Later, they sort of gave him that, like, Tila Tequila sectoid head. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, he looks like a high school principal in a toga.
Yeah.
Yeah, he hasn't gone full bobblehead at this point. Yeah.
Right, but that's a good description, because there is something a little off about it. Like, if you saw your principal at a toga party, you'd be like, I don't like this.
This is upsetting.
He's just watching everybody. It's so creepy.
With Johnny's going through this insane cosmic journey, the Punisher is just wrecking house on the roof of the Baxter Building. Galactus is rebuilding the planet-eating machine. And things are just looking bleak for our heroes.
Yeah, the Punisher is taking it to the thing.
Yeah.
Kirby's drawn like 20 limbs in a panel.
Yeah.
Just tornadoing on him.
He's using some like Looney Tunes moves.
Yeah.
It's like Tasmanian Devil. Yeah.
Tasmanian Devil. And
I like that. I don't know if I've seen kathuk, kathuk, kathuk as sound effects before. That was also what's happening. That's the sound of Tasmanian Devil hitting the thing.
So, yeah. So things are looking pretty dark. But wait. The Surfer decides that perhaps for the first time within memory, I have found something worth protecting. Nice. And he hops on his surfboard and he streaks toward Galactus. And the Watcher can't believe it. He did not see this coming. But he's also concerned because, as he says, without meaning to, the Silver Surfer may himself be the cause of Earth's destruction.
Well, he did bring Galactus there to eat the Earth. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, yes, I mean.
But now he's like, okay, but now he might be fucking up my plan to prevent that with his plan to prevent that.
Right.
Oh, if only somebody could do something about it.
Like, but I can't.
Manifest himself in front of them and complain about how he's not supposed to be doing this. But like, I do it all the time and it doesn't matter.
So that's the cliffhanger that we end on. This storyline is just insane. Like the whole Galactus, the first appearance of Galactus, it moves so quick. There's every page just has absolute mind-blowing stuff on it. I love this three-issue story arc. Like, it's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so fantastically weird. And it works in a total comic book way. Like, there's sort of an internal logic that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
It's not like a lot of Stan Lee stuff where it's like, okay, that sort of fell apart. It's just like, it's a little stupid, but it's under the umbrella of something that isn't totally crazy.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
If I'm explaining myself well.
No.
I think he's starting when Stan gets to this level of like cosmic level where anything is possible. Then more things work than you can suspend disbelief better than Magneto with the X-Mansion.
Right. Or the Inferno 42 tube.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had a spare one that glows just in case the original is busted.
Yeah.
Well, those feel like mistakes. Whereas when weird shit happens in these Galactus storylines, you're like, oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yep.
You can also tell like the books and the stories and the artists that are doing more of the storytelling before handing it off to Stan. Like, you know, this Fantastic Four feels totally different than anything else that came out this month. And you see a lot of this in like Kirby's later work, like his New Gods stuff. It just has this like fever dream logic to it, which is, it's so great.
It also seems like something that was truly inspiring, like, and inspired. So like, he's like, I have this great idea for this purple man from space to eat the planet. He has all the plot points, like, you know, beat it out much better than these other stories that sort of feel like a madman making them up as they go along.
Which is what they are.
Because that's absolutely how you would describe most of his process, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a drunk doing improv.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, gentlemen, we are coming to the end here. So what we have left is our panels of the month. Sean, as our guest, would you like to tell us what you've singled out for the panel that stuck out to you this month?
Let me find the one I like. It was from the front of one of those Captain America stories.
Okay.
It was one where
Iron Man was fighting the Mandarin.
Okay.
And the Mandarin pulls Tony Stark into his tower, thinking he's trying to get Iron Man. He can't find Iron Man. So he's like, I'm going to get Tony Stark because he knows Iron Man, and I'll make him tell me where Iron Man is. And then he's telling a story about how Iron Man whooped his ass. And it's, he says, for I can still feel the sting of his iron fist as it struck me. Me, the Mandarin, who had never known physical attack before. So here he is admitting, like, this is the only time anyone's dared fight him. And then in the very same panel, it has a picture of him very clearly slapping him with an open hand. And the Mandarin says, but eventually my chance will come. Once Ultimo has risen, I shall find the hated Avenger once more and destroy him barehanded with the mightiest karate chop ever known. Which, again, is very clearly a slap. And so here's this guy telling his fantasy to Tony Stark about how he lost a fist fight. He's never been in a fist fight. Oh, my God. But the next one, I will literally train so hard, I will have the best karate chop that has ever been. So hard, it will kill Iron Man. And in his own fantasy, he doesn't know what a karate chop is. It's so good. I love it.
Wonderful. Rob, what do you got?
Well, I have... this is from the Fantastic Four we were just talking about, 49, page 7, panel 1. It's just so weird. So I was sort of going backwards through the book looking for something that I was trying to remember. So I wasn't really following the linear story I'd already read. Hit this page. The first panel is just the Herald of Galactus sprawled on Alicia's couch with a plant knocked over next to him. And so without reading, so since he just fell into the skylight, he's knocked over the plant. But, you know, just seeing this scene without captions in that way, it looks like a classic annoying, like drunk roommate, except for the silver part. And
the silver nude part. Well, I guess a drunk roommate could also be nude. But,
so yeah. I painfully said to Barb, Norrin Rad, more like Norrin Rude, the cosmic couch surfer. Yeah. And, but it was, it resonated just because I was seeing this cosmic herald just laying on somebody's couch, just sprawled there. And then it just started to seem this couch surfer got stuck in my head and I could not stop, loving that panel.
Drunk and eat the refrigerator. Yeah. Eat the toilet.
Just the what worst need
have I of your toilet. I will translate it into matter and consume it.
I have no genitals.
The rest of us have to pee, dickhead.
You only pay a quarter of the utilities.
I have eaten your genitals. What? Look down. You are like me now.
Smooth.
Yeah.
Okay, Brian.
Well, Brian,
what
before
you
get to yours, oh, yeah. I have a second one.
Okay.
Remember we were talking about when Professor X got wrapped up in the mental wires. He knew exactly what was happening. It's like the one weapon. And then Cyclops runs over to get him, and a plexiglass wall drops down, and he face plants into it. And so Cyclops says out loud, someone's playing a cat and mouse game with us. In any game like that, it's Cyclops who turns into the cat, into a power blasting tiger. Awesome.
It's like,
and then he shoots the barrier and it immediately bounces back and like explodes on him. So like, it's another one of these perfect endings to these superheroes, like trying to sound all tough and immediately just screwing up.
Oh man, I want to memorize that and just use that to psych myself up in the mirror before shows. I'm a power blasting tiger. I'm a power blasting tiger.
Tiger cat.
Oh man. All right. My panel of the month is also from Fantastic Four. It's from page 16, panel 3. It's at the end of Johnny's cosmic odyssey. And it's when he arrives at Galactus's just amazing, weird Mobius strip spaceship. And like Kirby is just working overtime to just make this as cosmic as hell. It's just so good. And it's something like I probably read this for the first time like 30 years ago, 35 years ago. And I know this panel, like I can see this panel. If I think about it, it's just always stood out to me. So
I feel like Kirby took an extra day. Like, I don't think it was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. story where halfway through the story, it just hands off obviously to a different artist. And it said he was doing layouts, but I think Kirby was drawing part of it and then just he's like, I got to work on this Galactus ship. So somebody else is going to have to take this over, Stan. And he's like, I'm going to spend a whole day. I'm just going to sit there and smoke cigarettes and draw this ship. That's what I'm going to do. I'm Jack Kirby. And yeah,
I probably drew that ship like 50 times when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I actually put it in Calculords. If you look closely in one of the bosses, I did a pixel version of it, which it took all the fucking day.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
I have definitely, I don't think I've on Calculords, I have done everything but beat the Shadow Nerd, I think, at this point. But yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
There's the validation you were looking for. Man, Sean, thanks so much for doing this. This has been an absolute blast. Yeah. It's so good to see you.
You too.
Tell us before you go, tell us a little bit about 1-900 Hot Dog.
1-900 Hot Dog is the greatest comedy delivery system in the modern world. It's a daily comedy thing. Monday we do learning, where we teach you different things. Tuesday we do punching. Wednesday we do nerding. Thursday we do talking. And Fridays are for upsetting things. And each one of these days, we focus on broken artifacts from a wrong dimension. And that's it. That's the site.
Nice. So that's
the elevator pitch, all that 5 minutes of thing I said.
I love it.
Yeah. It's me and Robert Brockway, the cracked legend of many years. Jokes every day.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Like comedy used to be on the internet.
Yeah. 1-900hotdog.com. And there's various levels. There's free stuff. And then there's various levels of Patreon to unlock even more awesome stuff.
Oh, yeah. You can give us money if you like it. But yeah, if you don't want to give us money, you still can read several things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very worthwhile.
And in several years, I think we're going to get bought out by a big capital investment firm. And then we're going to pivot to viral news from several days ago that will all be user submitted. So enjoy the good comedy jokes while they're here. And then that's what we'll be in 2024. We hope.
All right. Fingers crossed, man. Good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
That was so fun.
All right. So that's it. Hit us up, marvelbythemonth.com. Send us an email, marvelbythemonth@gmail.com, at marvelbythemonth on Instagram. And I think that's it. Am I forgetting anything?
Just your normal sign off. That's it.
Right. Yeah. So this is the part where I say, for Marvel by the Month, my name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Mill.
And I'm a power blasting tiger.
Stay safe and stay healthy and stay inside and read comics. So
you edit all this out.
Yeah, yeah. Of course. We're professionals.
This is Brian's normal pain.
Yeah, I don't produce a podcast. I sculpt it. I look at the giant block of audio that we get, and I chip away all the parts that are not the podcast.
Like a Flavor of Love episode.
Exactly.